everyone. Welcome to the Basketball Victoria podcast. I'm Rob Coulter. With me, I have Mike Zeppel and Justin Shaw, the high performance coaches for Metro and Country. Welcome, guys.
G'day, mate.
Robbie.
Just a little bit of housekeeping from our end. Massive thanks to everyone that's downloaded and commented and shared the podcast to this point. We actually recorded our first three episodes probably about 3 weeks ago now. Not really too sure how it would be received. The feedback from everyone out there has been fantastic. We really appreciate the comments and any ideas that you guys might have as well. I think episode three drops today, actually. We're doing episode four for next week. So we're trying to keep up with what's going on. Yeah. We do have a name change. We are 3 weeks in and we've decided that we're not happy with the Blue Hoop podcast. We are now Talking Split. Which is fairly appropriate.
Very appropriate.
Big thanks to Zoe Carr for the name on that one. It took her about 30 seconds to accomplish what took us roughly 45 minutes in a room discussing.
She clearly listened to the first two. That's
obviously right. Obviously did. I think we discussed everything from is the earth really flat and just went off on weird tangents. So big thanks to everyone. If you do have any comments or topics you want covered, please let us know. We are now on iTunes. So please, if you could go and leave a review or like the post, I don't really know how iTunes works in all honesty, but if you could do something positive, that'd be fantastic and we'll go from there. Our topic this week is practice. The old Allen Iverson quote, I suppose, that's attached to it, but practice is probably something we don't get a lot of time to do with our kids. Like, we always sort of sit there and say, hey, in the States and in Europe, they get to practice daily. And that makes a big difference, whereas we get sometimes limited to a 45-minute session on half court with our kids, maybe once or twice a week, depending on what we're dealing with as well. So what are the big things in terms of maximising your own ability to plan practice and things that go with that? Where do you start, I suppose?
I mean, you just said it. We're limited, which means you absolutely have to plan the 90 minutes or, 2 hours that you have a week or a day or a weekend or whatever you've got. You have to plan it because we are limited. There are some schools that get access to their athletes a little bit more than clubs do, but given, the Wednesday-Sunday split that most BJBL clubs get, you do have to maximise your practice time, and to maximise your practice time, you've got to have it planned out.
Really? You also need to know what you're trying to achieve. So there's a great ability to practice for the sake of practice, but actually having a goal of what you're trying to achieve that day, making sure you're hitting those points and over the course of a season hitting everything that you need to help the athletes get better. It's why we practice. So, having that clear focus on what we want is pretty important too.
So it's a bit of long-term versus short-term, I suppose, with that as well. Like, you get your first team and you're working out, hey, where do we want to go with this? You probably need to know what your end goal is and work back from there. It would be
absolutely.
Yep.
I believe heavily in periodization and knowing, kind of having some checkpoints through a season where you want to kind of have the group at. One keeps you accountable to kind of what you've got to get done and not staying stuck on one thing for too long, but also having that end goal. And everyone wants to win the title, so that shouldn't be the end goal. It should be about, we're going to be the best defensive transition team, or we're going to be the best at a hockey assist, whatever it might be, and figure out ways to work back from that. The other part is pre-season. It's tough to get a pre-season in Victoria, but making sure that you do have a stage where you are working on the athlete's functional strength as well as, a little bit of basketball conditioning to help them actually perform, not trying to smash them out day one of practice and then have them break down, et cetera, et cetera. So having a plan over a long period is important.
Yeah, and I called mine my master practice plan, which I stole, 3 or 4 years ago when I was planning the last couple of years out. I used it and I broke it up into offense, defense, special situations, and fundamentals. And from there, I had a series of things that I wanted to cover in each. And then by the end of the year, hopefully that whole document was covered, and I knew that my athletes would have touched each of those points, because you don't want to get to the middle of the season, find out you're not closing out very well, then look at your master plan and figure out, well, we didn't do closeouts ever. So I think that's important to have a big picture before you even take off.
Yeah, is it one of those things where you drive the goals, or is that player-driven as well? It'll depend a little bit on your age group. You obviously can't have too in-depth a chat with your under-12 team about, where do we want to head with this, but how much of it is player-driven and how much of that is coach-driven?
I think it's got to be a club focus. Like, if we're in club land, the club's got to have, obviously, a bigger blueprint plan of what the goals are for each age group and each team and what we're going to get through. Each individual team's going to be about getting some wins and enjoyment along the way. And then from a coaching perspective, how can I help that athlete, the individual athlete, the collective athletes, get better so that they leave my program and go on to continue to progress. So within that, there's got to be a way that you can formulate practice well from there.
Yeah, and we've got to be better next Friday night than we were this Friday night. Like that's a short-term goal, but for these athletes to get better, for us to get better as coaches, we just got to keep getting better. And I know it sounds pretty simple, but you do have to continually improve and grow throughout the course of your year.
Yeah, no question. And I think probably if we were looking at a VJBL season, I'll probably talk to that given I'm still coaching Friday nights at the moment. I'm coaching under 12s. So for mine, the win and the loss isn't really all that relevant to us. We'll view our games this season as really just another training session, just obviously with a scoreboard. So from my end, all my session plans this year are fundamental driven. It's skill based, it's ball handling, passing, shooting, dribbling, and that's kind of it for my guys. I don't think I need to do more than that.
I think what you've said there, though, is really something to take away is that the game is where you actually get better. So you can practice, you can put stuff in place. If your fundamentals are getting better, the result gets better. So it kind of takes care of itself. And I think that's a great message for people is to go, all right, yeah, we're trial and erroring. That's what the game is. All right, we're putting everything in place. The work's getting done during the week, but the game is the trial and error. And we'll either get better at it or we won't. And that's where we've got to review and figure it out from that.
And I think the big thing from my end is that I have to coach the kids through it. Because they are young athletes, they don't really understand what is good and what is bad. They think ball goes in, ring must be good, despite how I've shot it or anything like that. I'm probably fairly critical of coaches that sit there and say, hey, it's trial and error and I'm just going to let you guys go and do it. Yeah. They don't really understand yet what trial and error learning is because they don't really understand what are the long-term repercussions or consequences of doing it one way over the other way. So from my end, I come off those courts dripping in sweat, and that's a little bit because I'm incredibly unfit. But also, I'd spend so much time coaching, and you've got to get down at their level and talk to them, things like that. That's where a lot of my session plans are now at with under-12s is purely ball-in-hand things and making them make decisions one-on-one, two-on-two. Mike, you're probably across the state things. So if we had a coach that was planning out, say, an under-16 state team, for example, what would their session plan start to incorporate?
Yeah, I mean, again, they would have the master plan and what they want that 12 weeks to look like, and you'll have so many things that you want to cover off week to week, month to month in the lead up to the tournament. To Justin's point before around periodization, important because you're battling National Junior Classics, you're battling Friday night, you're battling school tournaments, things like that. So really important that they're taking all of that into consideration. Because you don't want a fresh and healthy team when you do leave. So that's important. Implementing your base defense, your base offense, and then figuring out how you're going to use that at a tournament, really important. And that's a work in progress over 12 months and then over the three-month campaign as well. So yeah, for those coaches,
I think any sort of campaign, maximizing the time in the practice session so you can hit everything. Like it's funny, the higher the level you coach at, the less time you get to prep. Yeah. So it's then about, well, how can I maximize that time? How can I utilize my coaching staff more to get a high, vibrant, buzzing environment? We always preach with our state programs, it's got to be an environment where success is inevitable. So you can't come into that environment and leave feeling that you didn't get better, you didn't get a good workout, you didn't improve your IQ. So it's got to be an environment where success is inevitable. How do we generate that? Well, planning has to be efficient. So I'm not spending, 20 minutes on one drill. I've always had a thing where 7 minutes, skill acquisition coach that I worked with, 7 minutes is the maximum we're going to get out of an athlete on one kind of concept.
So that's actually doing the skill time, that's not including your talking and explaining.
Yeah, so usually on my plan, I'll allocate maybe 10 minutes because there's some instructional time, but it's 7 minutes of physically getting into it. And the second that drill's on, it's coaching on the run. So it is the trial and error, but it's detailed within the trial and error. So my cues are going to be on footwork or it's going to be on spacing points or whatever it may be. But that's how we kind of build that. And then we're moving through that checklist Zep talks about. All right, today we need to tick off by the end of this practice, dot, dot, dot. That doesn't mean that's the right way to do it. That's just how I've always found it. I've heard other people just not move on until they're 100% satisfied with something. But I think the higher you go, the less time you get. So you do have to move on, hit everything, but try and be as efficient as you can.
And Robbie, your point to fundamentals, they haven't got that time.
Yep.
They've got 8 weeks to 12 weeks. They get their fundamental touch in their warm-ups and their cool-downs and shooting in there, but they haven't got the time to spend on the footwork, etc., that you would with your bottom age under 12 this year. So, yeah, they're running against the clock.
Yeah, and that is probably one of the hard part too, is prioritising. It's I know this time of year in particular, teams have just been picked. We're about to move into grading phase as well. A lot of coaches, as soon as they get their team, are putting offence in straight away and, hey, this is how we're going to fix this and this is what we're going to do defensively with this. This is our press break. It's really easy to gloss over the skill development as well, and it's a really important part. And it doesn't need to be anything spectacular. That could just be part of your warm-up is going to be skill development. If you can do some two-ball dribbling or some passing or something like that, that could be your warm-up before you even hit the court. Get there 10 minutes early, get that done on the side of the court while other teams are training. It's a really easy way to get it done
as
well.
You hear us say it all the time, like the fundamentals are the fundamentals. They've got to be worked on constantly. And then from that, once the fundamentals are great, everything else becomes a lot easier. So you've got to keep constantly paying attention to that. And that will be that athlete's kind of thing from now until they're a retired pro. Like the whole time they're going to be working on those elements.
So Justin, you're involved with Oz teams at the moment. So you've had a fairly disjointed prep, it'd be fair to say, given you never know when your tournament actually hits.
It's a little all over the place, yeah.
How do you go about planning for that when you really don't know when your end goal is?
It's a good question. Like, I guess our camp environment's 3 days, so that's roughly a max of 6 sessions. So again, trying to utilise that time where you're working with athletes from all over the country and then trying to get them on the same page in that point. And what was interesting in that the first camp we ran is I only planned the first 2 sessions. So there was an offensive focus, a defensive focus, and then we planned thereafter. So once we felt we were comfortable to move on, yep, we'll add something else. And I think that comes down to, just to go back to what you were saying there before, you've got to have your philosophy and what you believe in and then make sure that that goes into a practice world. The difference at an Australian level is you don't really have time to invest in your fundamentals because it's a team camp prep. So you've got to get your systems in, practice it, trial and error as much as you can, and then bang, you're away for the tournament. Fortunately, now that tournament's been pushed back a little further and we'll get another chance to improve. But, you know, in the real world of it, you've got to know, am I a defensive coach? Bang, that's what I'm going to put in first. And that's kind of always been my philosophy, always until this camp, because I thought, well, we need to also be able to play together. So actually, offense matters for this one camp a bit more. So, you know, again, I don't think there's a right or wrong, but at that level, it's just purely about getting everyone on the same page, getting some continuity and trying to play right off the bat. You know, we're straight into one demo, 5-on-5, here we go.
Yep. I think there's a lot to be said about sort of two-way teaching in any of your sessions as well.
Yeah, definitely.
As much as it might be an offensive drill, put some defense in just to start working that side of it as well and flip it. Obviously, there's not much point doing, you know, slides for 2 slides, then drop step and slide. You may as well throw a ball handler on there as well.
I don't think any athlete enjoys just one side of the ball in any sort of practice environment, whereas if it's got a competitive element, one, we're teaching athletes how to be competitive, which is a need these days.
Mm-hmm.
Two, now we're able to coach a couple things on the run. They're getting benefit out of both things at the same time. Bang, now you don't need extra time spending on that later on. I think that's a massive point.
Great opportunity to utilise your assistant coaches in that capacity too. So if you're the head coach and you're leading an offensive drill, if you have an assistant coach who's focused on the defensive side of the ball and maybe a second assistant that's focused on defensive rebounding, you can touch multiple things in the same drill if you're using your resources well like that. So I've seen a lot of good practices and heard from a lot of assistant coaches. The only thing they're looking at all day is defensive rebounding or closeouts or who's jumping to the ball. Like, that's just one focus, and they'll coach that thing for the whole 90 minutes, which I think brings great value.
Definitely does. I suppose the other thing you really do need to be mindful of is how much you're stopping drills or how much you're stopping practice as well, because, I mean, players like to go. They don't want to be stopping, listening to the coach, starting, going for 20 seconds, stopping again so the coach can talk as well. the ability to coach on the run is really important, and it is one of those things where you need to explain, okay, this is the drill, here's the teaching points within it, off you go for a couple of minutes, now we'll look to stop it, rather than stopping it every 30 seconds. And you don't really want to stop your drill just to talk to one kid. If five or six kids are making the same mistake, well, okay, now we'll stop the drill. If it's just one kid, we'll just grab them out of the back of the line and talk to them and work them through it as well.
Yeah, one of our state coaches, Jared Hillier, who's got an army background, spoke to me about that once, about one of their sergeants got them to record themselves because extra words in battle can end in negative results. And he brought that philosophy into coaching, and so I did, and I was kind of shocked at how many extra words and how long it took to say something. So I think it is a good practice to just record yourself every once in a while and just see, or video the session and watch how many times the athletes aren't actually moving. You know, you can't afford that. Like, if you've got limited time for prep, mass participation drills, figure out how the athletes are constantly doing stuff in the session. Your communication points, figure out how you can just get something in and then move on, and then let the messy happen. Like, you know, there's been a few really good lectures with Basketball Australia of late about the messy and being comfortable with that. It's the way people learn, is trial and error, figuring it out, giving constant feedback, coaching on the run. It's an important part of how athletes will evolve.
Mm. So what you're saying is that you're listening to all these podcasts, checking how you've been going and adjusting for the next one?
Quit wasting words, mate.
Need to definitely tidy up the word count, I think.
That's a good point. There is still time and place where you have to stop the drill and make sure everybody understands that as a head coach, this is what I value, and you will value it too if you want to play for me. And I do think that the athlete who may have made the blunder the last two or three possessions needs to know that, but everybody needs to know that. The assistant coaches need to know that. And there is still a forceful message that can get put across to what you value.
To your point there, like, something we haven't touched on yet is, and it gets lost often because everyone's rushing from one thing to the other, but just meeting with your coaching staff, whether that's one assistant, a raft of people that are helping you out, meeting with them pre-practice, just hit over what we're covering today, if there's any key points that you really want to address, so that it's a clear understanding of that. So again, now that's saving time as well. We're not having to explain to the coaching staff as well what's going on. Get everyone on the same page early, and now you're going to have a much more efficient practice.
Yeah.
And we'll probably sort of move on to the tournament side of session plans as well. So now, we're going to assume we're in tournament play. That might be Australia Day weekend. That might be Easter Carnivals. That might be Classic. That might be Nationals, World Qualifiers, whatever the case may be. How do you deal with training in that environment as well? Because there's obviously an element where you need to be able to give direct feedback from games. So we're going to assume you've taped games and you need to give video feedback as well. What are the roles and what are the things you're looking for in your video feedback?
So I guess from an Australian point of view, I'll give is we would always conclude that day's game by the end of that day. So review has to happen of us always, whether we've won, lost, been great, been terrible, got to review it. And we're looking at, I'm big on trying to find the positives in it. So here's what we're doing really well, and here's a couple things that we need to do better. Wording it really specifically like that so that the next day we can hit that. The next day's event is about whoever we're playing. So pre-video, before practice, they've seen their main three sets. That's all I care about. What are their main three actions? I should say actions, not sets, because if they're living through the post, they're great in transition and, you know, it lasts 8 seconds. Well, they're the three things that we're worrying about. What are they getting to in that point? Then you go into practice and you can take care of it. The actual practice itself, for me, there's got to be a review of you. So getting some run-throughs of your stuff. You might be tweaking something that day to expose what you know they're going to do. Getting shots up and actually some sweat up on what you want to do. But on game day, I'm massive on nothing full court. It's all half court. It's not sprints. It's just, you know, getting them their reps. Then it's review of them. So get through scout. And then you're done. You know, and then internationally, you get 50 minutes. So you've got to be efficient again with that practice, hit all those benchmarks, and away you go.
Yeah, you haven't got a lot of time. The athletes have to get in, they've got to get out. A way that I like to end practice is if I know, like, the opponent's coming up that evening or, you know, the next day, even with our Big V group last year, was ending practice the way we would open the next game. So if I knew I was playing Queensland South that night, we would end that shoot around, the 50-minute shoot around. We'd run that first four sets of how we would open that game that night. So I call it scripting, and I think it just ends practice on a positive note, gives the athletes some clarity about how we're going to start in 3 or 4 hours' time, and hopefully make a few shots and get on out of there.
I think the review of yourself is massive. I think coaches can get really hung up on, hey, I need to be across what the other team is doing, and there's certainly a lot of value in that too. I think I'd be surprised if every game you play you can't find 10 points you can pick up somewhere by just the timing of your cut can get better, and that's something you can fix at training, obviously.
I think in tournaments as well, like, you should have a blueprint of how we defend certain actions. So when you're actually going through how we're going to cover the opposition, it shouldn't be something brand new. Like, if you're adding something brand new in a tournament, you've probably got some challenges there. To me, and people have probably heard me say this before, this time spent on yourself, I think, is so much more valuable in tournament play. Because you can get bluffed, especially if you're winning, that you're going pretty good and everything's fine, and then suddenly someone takes something away and we don't know what we're doing. So that review of us and trying to preempt, right, if I'm coaching against me today, what would I try and take away? So then spend some time on that. So, you know, if it's a ball reversal, well, now we'll work on back cutting and opening the floor up and whatnot. Trying to have that part in tournament play is pretty important from a coaching perspective in how you plan each game day prep.
Yep, I don't disagree with that at all. It's how much shooting would you do mid-tournament as well? Is that something that you sit there and say, hey, this is not relevant to us, we've got the shots we're going to get at this point, or do you see them in a part of your session where it's just going to be shots and just bulk repetitions?
Kids like to see the ball go through the hole.
Yeah.
And I think helps confidence, but also just helps them keep a good, clear head that they're going to make shots that evening as well. So anytime you can block out 4 or 5 minutes in between drills to get some volume shooting or mass shooting in, then get into something else and then move on to some shooting and then get into something else. I think that's just helps you flow of practice in tournament or even during season.
Yeah, like, I like to have some sort of individual element in that game day practice as well. So we might review our sets, split guards and bigs, they get some reps on specifics for them, but then do some team rhythm shooting. And that just comes down to what I value as a coach. Like, shooting matters to me. Other coaches may not feel as strongly with that. But the thing that I think is important is not emphasizing how important it is to get game day shots, because there will be this time in a tournament where you don't get to shoot that day just because of schedule, doubleheader day, whatever, and you can't impact the athletes' minds on, I haven't had my shots today, I'm not going to be ready. So figuring out ways to just keep, you know, consistent on the messaging, but not emphasising that it's a be-all and end-all that happens.
How do you deal with someone, maybe mid-tournament, that, and this is probably another topic for another time, but I'll digress slightly at the moment. How do you deal with someone that is a shooter that's not making shots mid-tournament? Like, how much are you giving them in regards to, are we working on this at training? Are we not even addressing it at all? Is it just, hey, work it out?
To me, it comes, for me and my philosophy, it's not about whether the ball's going through the net, it's whether it's been the right shot. So whether an athlete's shooting it or not, the question to them, instead of it being about make or miss, is, was it the right shot to take? If the answer is yes, then keep taking that shot and just try and sell that mindset that it's actually the process, it's not the result we care about, and really try and hound that home. And I think if that's the culture you breed within a program, then those slumps tend to not happen as much because you're focusing on the actual how, not the outcome.
I saw a great clip during the week, and I'd love to be able to share it. It's Billy Donovan at a lecture recently, and he talks about how 95% of the game is played without the basketball.
I actually retweeted that yesterday.
At Jay Shuler on Twitter.
15, you can go and find at Jay Shuler 15.
I thought it was great. It goes about 2 minutes, but he speaks about that exact thing. Yeah, okay, you're missing shots, but there's 95% of this game that does not include shooting. It includes boxing out and competing and keeping the ball in front and defensive rebounding, and there's so much more to the game than making the shot. So I think that's really important, that your athletes understand that as a whole as well. You're not here just to make shots. There's a whole heap of other things that we got to get done.
Definitely.
Just as we wind up, I suppose, what are the three must-haves at every training session you run? Justin, we'll put you on the spot.
Yeah, for me it is shooting. You've got to work on the master skill that's got to happen. From a defensive side of the ball, it's absolutely D-trans and ball screen D. So we would hit that every single session. And then the last one is ball movement for me. So that can be done 101 different ways, but having some sort of focus on getting the ball moving, working on the extra pass, finding a different way to go.
Yep. Mike, what do you got?
Closeouts would be my number one. I'd usually start a practice with closeouts. I think you've got to play one-on-one basketball. The game is played in one-on-one situations an awful lot, and then shooting as well. If you can't get some quality volume shooting and game shots into your practices, when are your athletes ever going to get it? They're not going to get it on Friday night. They're not going to get it in their school competition. You've got to find 8 minutes. You know, a couple times during practice is enough to get a lot of quality shots up. So that would be my three.
I'd always be late to your sessions, mate. I don't turn up for defensive drills.
You wouldn't play for me, Rob.
Yeah, I don't know if I've got a role in many of your teams.
You would work your periodisation out properly, Rob.
I would. I'd periodically turn up 10 minutes late to every session. Probably for mine, the big things would be shooting. Obviously, I'll touch on that. One versus one, just disadvantage, advantage, and then it'd be two versus one, obviously, if you're looking for the disadvantage type concept. And passing. We had Tony Ronzone come out and do a clinic for us last week who spoke about the value of passing and being able to deliver the ball under pressure in unconventional ways. And he sort of touched on chest passes don't really exist in our game anymore. And it's a fairly valid point.
Second that.
Yep. So he was all about push passes and flick passes and trying to find other ways and letting kids be a bit creative with that. I think disadvantage is a great way to incorporate your shooting practice as well as your passing practice with that too.
Great.
Anything else from either of you guys?
No, I just think the key element for any coach has to be the athlete has to leave your practice better. Yeah. With 100%. A positive mindset, feeling good about it, and it should be a high-energy environment. Biggest frustration I have is when I see coaches at practice not coaching. So remember always that you're there to help people get better. Coaches coach.
And you can clearly tell, as a bypassing coach, anybody, a planned practice versus an unplanned practice. And a planned practice looks methodical, the athletes are engaged, they know what's happening. I think just planning, just spending the 30 minutes to plan practice just adds incredible value to the session, but then your athletes, because they do have to get better.
And there's all sorts of templates available online in regards to how you plan out your practice, what you put in, like Excel spreadsheets, Microsoft Word spreadsheets and things. If you want copies of session plans, by all means send me an email and I'll send you out some templates as well that we use here. Hopefully that's helped with your practice planning for this week. Again, if you do have anything you would like us to touch on in the podcast, by all means, drop me an email. Please do share this around as much as we can. We do want as many people involved in this discussion as we can. And we'll go from there. Good luck with your coaching and talk to you guys next week.
For this week's Shot Clock, we are joined from Jared Hillier from Southern Peninsula Vic Country fame.
First team you ever coached?
Southern Penn under 16 boys.
Your favourite NBA team?
Boston Celtics.
Your favourite NBL team?
Melbourne United.
Ooh, controversial. Sure, yeah. We're all like that. Yeah. Your favourite WNBL team?
Bendigo Spirit.
That's okay. That's what I said too. That's not a bad thing at all. What's your most used coaching phrase?
Get in the damn paint.
Any coaching superstitions?
No, whatsoever.
Which coach do you steal from the most?
Todd. Probably Peter Lonigan.
Yep.
Yeah.
What's your favourite coaching website?
Ooh. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just going to go Twitter on that one because I'll just follow all the links.
Yep. And any coaching podcast you listen to?
This one right here.
Brand promotion, I like it. Mate, thanks very much for your time. For the second half of today's podcast, I'd like to welcome Adam McKay from Helping Hoops. Thanks for joining us, Adam.
G'day, thanks for having me.
No problems at all. I guess the best place for us to start is the beginning. So Helping Hoops has been around for how long now?
Coming on 8 years now, yeah.
And people probably wouldn't even have realised that you guys have been around that long. It's massive what you guys have done in this space in a short period of time, but a long period of time at the same time.
Yeah, it's definitely been a big 8 years for us. I mean, we started fairly, you know, humbly with just one program as a passion project. And, you know, from there it just grew organically, two programs, three programs. So I guess right now to be sitting at 10 programs every week and doing over 450 sessions, for the community, it's you do sort of look back at the last 8 years and go, wow, what a busy time it's been, but also sort of maybe look forward as well and just think, right, what's the next 8 years and going to look like for us. So
for those coaches out there that aren't aware, what is Helping Hoops? I mean, where did it start on that first sort of session and what's it grown to now?
Yeah, well, I guess, Helping Hoops is a bit different to a lot of other organisations. We're a charity, so our approach, to basketball, to actually helping kids is by using basketball as a vehicle to, instill values and achieve social outcomes. So, we just started with one program for kids with an intellectual disability and branched out to include, migrant refugee background kids, public housing, estates. But, as much as we have grown, I think the essence of Helping Hoops has always remained the same. It's those positive relationships between, the head coaches, the volunteer assistant coaches, and the kids, and, making sure that those, skills they have off the court to attack life are really focused on. The fact that these kids may become great at basketball is really, a byproduct for us. But, we obviously love the game. We're all passionate about basketball, and, it's a pretty, amazing place to be.
It is. And basketball is a fantastic vehicle for all this sort of stuff as well. I mean, there's obviously the competitive stream as well, and sometimes it's just the social stream that goes with this as well. It's not necessarily the win and the loss. Sometimes it is building relationships and building kids up and putting them on a pathway to go and do something that can be really meaningful in their lives. Sometimes they end up being coaches, sometimes referees. Can't always be winners in that field as well, obviously. But it's something that can really keep kids engaged with just progressing themselves as people, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing I've come to appreciate about basketball more than anything is just the the scalability of it. I mean, we can be dealing with kids with pretty, challenging intellectual disabilities who may not even be able to hoist the ball up over the hoop, but they get a lot out of basketball, right up to the kids who are jumping out the gym and dunking on each other and may go on to actually play at a professional level and everywhere in between. So I guess, basketball, it's everyone's game. That's the catchphrase. But, we live and breathe that every day, and it's just amazing. I'm sure other sports are the same to varying degrees, but, all I know is basketball, really. And, for us, it's the perfect vehicle to actually engage with these kids, no matter their background, their ability, their skill level, or what's going on in their lives outside of Helping Hoops or, basketball in general.
So how did this all get started? You sort of said it started with one session. Did you have a basketball background at all, or did you just jump into this and say, hey, this is what I'm really passionate about?
Look, my basketball career ended before it began, really. I sort of...
Finally, someone else that's like me.
We can't all, but it's good because you can tell great stories about your career then. So I'll embellish that at a later date. But no, look, I grew up in Adelaide. Don't hold that against me, guys. But I made it out to Victoria, so it all worked out okay. I played at the representative level up until I was, say 18. I had a couple of retina detachments, which really sort of put an end to any aspirations I had. I wouldn't have made it, to any level regardless, but at least...
no one knows that, though.
At least I've got an excuse now, exactly. So I've given myself away, actually. I actually fell out of love with the game of basketball for about 8 years.
Yep.
I didn't want to see a basketball. I didn't want to watch a game. It just reminded me of what I'd lost, basically. I sort of look back now and it was probably, it was a big, sort of hole in my life. But I guess through my own kids, having, them grow up and going to the park and seeing the outdoor hoops and... all right. And then, one day digging out the old basketball and... and then taking it down, and as soon as you flick that wrist and you see the ball go in, well, it didn't go in the first time, but you hear that net swish and it all comes back and you're like, man, I really... And since then, I've made up for 8 years, it feels, in the time since then. So, how it all started, I was, running my own, small business, as a sole trader, back around, sort of 2006 to 2010, and... I didn't really get a lot of interaction with... I didn't have any work colleagues. I didn't have any sort of, clients, obviously, and my family, but I didn't really, sort of have that community, that I value so much now. And, I a friend of mine and myself used to just volunteer our time once a week at the Mordialloc Community Centre. Would have been like 08, 09, I reckon. Okay. And yeah, we used to run a 1 hour session for after school, you know, kids not underprivileged or disadvantaged in any way. You know, it's they were just, you know, kids who I think paid their couple of bucks, and you know, we sort of tried our best to run a good session, but. Look, that became a highlight of my week, to be honest. Like, I just was really looking forward to that session more than anything. And I thought, oh, cool, I really, you know, would love to get involved more in basketball again. And, you know, I'm not sure what sparked it, but there was that thought of, oh, there must be some, you know, organisations out there, like, you know, sort of who are doing basketball for people who might not have the opportunity to play the game, you know, as a lot of, as I enjoyed when I was growing up. But, you know, looking out there, and I didn't really see anything. You know, there's a lot for soccer. There was a lot for AFL. You know, with respect, there was a lot of inclusion happening in organised basketball. But, you know, sort of what I had in mind was a Helping Hoops kind of model, and I assumed it existed, and it didn't. So, yeah, had a go. And, as I said, you know, just did one program per week as a bit of a, I guess, a passion project. And that, you know, we had an opportunity to do two and then three and then four, back to three, up to four, you know, and then, you know, that's sort of been the last 8 years, and it's really become, well, obviously it's become very serious, you know, in that time. But at the start, it was just, you know, love of the game, love of getting out there and interacting with kids. And I think if that's your basis for doing stuff, then I'm sure all the listeners would probably have that as well. You know, that's a pretty, it can take you many places, but if at your core, that's why you get into coaching and basketball, I mean, that's a pretty good place to start, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So where do you guys run out of now? So you've got 10 programs, I think it is, mm-hmm. across yep. Victoria. So what are the types of programs that you run now? Because it's not just basketball for you know, the mainstream, so to speak. There's plenty of other sort of pathways that go down that as well.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, look, we're geographically, we're out in locations like, you know, say Dandenong, you know, Werribee, Broadmeadows, a lot of the inner city areas as well, you know, with the public housing. So, you know, Fitzroy, Richmond, North Melbourne, and everywhere in between. But, I mean, you're exactly right. It's for us, it's about, I guess, you know, making a promise to these kids each and every week and fulfilling that promise. And, I mean, that sounds like common sense or, you know, to a lot of people, but I think for a lot of the kids that we're dealing with, whether they're in public housing or from a migrant or refugee background, you know, a lot of the time they have volatility in their life where they're getting let down all the time. So to simply have a group of, you know, people like us who make a promise and just fulfill that promise even before you pull a ball out and start, you know, bouncing it with them, I think that alone is really powerful. Then if you add on to that, I guess, you know, what we're trying to do to you know, mentor these kids to, you know, to instill positive values, you know, that adds another layer to it. And yeah, it's just a, you know, it's just a really vibrant, fun place to be with the best people on earth, to be honest. You know, it's just a really cool, you know, inspiring place to go and visit and hang out.
Yeah, definitely. So the coaches that you guys have that work with these kids must be fantastic people, obviously.
They're okay.
Yeah, they're okay.
Yeah,
I know a couple of them. A few of them are probably a little bit better than okay, in all honesty. But who are the coaches that you guys have working with all these players? Because, I mean, that's probably their first contact point in a lot of ways. So if their first experience is positive with their coach, it's going to go a long way towards keeping them involved.
Yeah, so I guess to set it up, I mean, our model is to have a head coach at each program. You know, they have the responsibilities of you know, all the boring stuff of, you know, designing the activities and making sure they're linked back to our social outcomes and, you know, the I say curriculum, the loose curriculum that I guess we have, but, and then, you know, doing the reporting, et cetera. So, you know, they've got the, you know, the I guess that true head coaching responsibility. And then they're assisted at a program by anywhere between, you know, 4 to 6, volunteer assistant coaches.
Yep.
All of these, you know, guys and girls have started with us as volunteers, you know, as I guess I started, you know, initially as well. So, you know, when we have actually had an opportunity to expand, add a new program or look to, you know, sort of get a new head coach on board, we're actually choosing from our amazing cohort of volunteers, of which we've got about, you know, 40 on board each and every week, you know, which is great. So, yeah, look, I mean, I guess, you know, these people may not be able to get a big V team to a championship, but they, as you said, they're excellent at building these relationships with the kids and being that, you know, we're not going to replace a parent or, but, you know, maybe we could be an honorary uncle or auntie, you know. Yep. And I think the thing for us that makes it such a great you know, place to be is that, you know, these people are giving up their time. They're you know, making that commitment and following through on that, you know, each and every week. And it takes a certain kind of person to do that. So we get to see the best part of humanity on a daily basis. And excuse your view of how good people are in a very positive way sometimes. So when you get cut off in traffic, you get reminded of it again. But when you're at Helping Hoops, you're amongst some pretty awesome coaches and some pretty cool kids.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, the best part I feel like is those coaches as well put a lot of time into their own craft as well. Like, we've had a number of the coaches that have come to our coaching clinics and coaching accreditation, things like that. They're trying to make themselves better so they can make the athletes better. And that is their main driving point, is they just want to make the athletes better. They want to be engaged with them. They want to give them some positive reinforcement that goes with them, something to look forward to as well. It's we get really hung up on the win and the loss a lot, I feel like,
with our
coaching, but this is a great avenue for kids to be involved, and the coaches, absolutely, is just that first level of contact, and if they have a real positive experience, well, they're going to come back.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's no, I guess our kids, because we're not putting teams into associations, or, you know, there's no sort of win-loss or competition attached to it. It is engagement, it is participation-based. You know, they're not, oh, I've got to get to training, otherwise my minutes are going to get cut, or, you know. So they're only literally, you know, turning up to a Helping Hoop session if they want to be there. You know, if it's not relevant or fun, but, you know, they'll let us know pretty quickly.
Yep.
They'll vote with their feet. So, yeah, so the fact that the coaches, you know, put so much time into designing the activities, you know, making sure they're relevant, making sure that they're meaningful. You know, it's not just sport for sport's sake. There's a bigger picture, you know, sort of goal or context around it. It is amazing, and I could never do what they do, to be honest. And, yeah, it's just, you know, really tip my hat to the amount of dedication that they put into to their craft.
Yep, you know? It's fantastic. And, I mean, coaches are all the same. You like to think that everyone gets into it for the kids, and that really is the driving factor, I feel like, that, you know, when you come away from a good session, you feel better. It's just one of those things, like, you just... A kid comes up and says, thanks, I really enjoyed it, or like, keep turning up and you see progression. That's what you really take away from those sorts of sessions as well.
Definitely. I mean, to see a kid over a period of time grow, you know, whether it's athletically their game gets better, or whether it's, you know, sort of their attitude or whatever it is. I mean, that's something in you know, mainstream basketball in the team environment that happens all the time. And that's, you know, the most rewarding part, I would assume, for that side. But also, you know, for us, it's... you know, those little wins make up, it's everything, you know. That's what you hang your hat on and keeps you coming back, and just being able to get to know these kids. You know, some kids we've known for 4, 5, 6 years, and, like, you know, they've grown, you know, physically, but also metaphorically as well. And it's, you know, it's a really cool thing, because you remember, you know, you sound like an old person sometimes going, I remember when you were, you know, were shorter than me, which happens a lot. They outgrow you physically pretty quickly. But,
yeah, I know that feeling well, unfortunately. Yeah. But I used to think 6'2 was tall, and then all of a sudden it's like, hang on, I'm coaching 14-year-olds at a 6'4. And life is different.
It's not fair.
It's not, is it?
Yeah.
But, you know, you always used to say, but I was much better when I was back in my day. And, you know, you can relate back. And Google wasn't around when I was playing, so all my stats were never really around. So
that's a good point,
actually. Yeah, it's the only thing I've got anymore, in all honesty. Yeah. It's just sort of try and lie to them a little bit.
Dot that out yourself,
yeah,
maybe.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a Wikipedia site going around somewhere of all Rob Calder's achievements, and none of them are true, like, I promise you.
That's a good idea after this, though.
Yeah. So... In terms of engaging with communities and things like that as well, how do you guys go about getting kids to turn up to your sessions? Obviously, you make them fun and those sorts of things, but there are clubs out there that have probably had similar problems that they may not be able to bake into the communities and get those kids engaged and coming to games and things like that.
Well, look, I guess for us, you know, we're not tied to a geographical location. Like, we'll go literally where the community is, you know. So first step for us when we're designing or launching a new program is to look at, right, where is the demand, where is the need, where is, you know, the local place where these kids play ball, you know, and we take it there. And look, sometimes it may be at Eagle Stadium, which is, you know, the Lamborghini of stadiums.
Yep, nice place.
Yeah, or it may be not, you know, somewhere that's not quite, I'm not going to drop any names there, you know, and for us, like, you know, location and relevance to the community is everything. And sometimes it means that we may be out on a public housing estate in the outdoor weather in June, where it's freezing cold and windy, and, you know, you've got to basically treat it like putting in golf, where you allow for the wind to sort of, you know, put your shot in. But that's fine. That's what it's all about. So I know that, I guess, in association land, you don't have that luxury, because, you know, there's a set venue. But my advice would be, if you are looking to engage multicultural communities or diverse communities, like, you know, don't be rigid and stubborn in those in your expectations. Realize you're going to actually have to go out into the community to bring them back into yours. It's easier said than done. I know the challenges. You know, it's none of us have got money. We've all, you know, struggling for time, and it's hard to make that happen. But I've just seen the benefit and results of actually, you know, going out to the coalface of where this need is, and actually, you know, planting our flag, you know, directly there, and breaking down the barriers of distance and money and things like that. And look, you know, in itself, that's a good thing for these kids. But also, if you're looking at it from, you know, the bigger picture of organized basketball in Victoria, then, you know, that's a breadcrumb that leads from back into the sport as well. And yeah, something I'm talking to a lot of people in this building about is, you know, how can we do that? And, you know, we want to see more representation of the amazing, you know, diversity, you know, from the, whether it's the East African background kids, whether it's, you know, kids in public housing, that, you know, just making sure that they've got that first touch point to then lead them back into, you know, playing the game, and you know, making sure those barriers are reduced, I guess, you know.
A lot of that's trust. I mean, you've got to build a relationship with the athletes as well. They have to trust you that, hey, you have their best interests at heart. You are trying to do this for their benefit. And it's not a quick fix. Like, it is something that's got to be built over time.
Absolutely. I think if you're looking at saying, hey, look, we want to, you know, get more diversity into the club, into our club. We want to go out to these communities. Let's run, you know, one session.
Yep.
Let's run two sessions. You're wasting your time.
Yep.
You know, you need to. Sometimes with us, it may take 6 months before we feel we've got, like, you know, just a zero with a kid. Before you start getting into the positive, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, you've got to take a long-term approach. And once again, I'm mindful of the fact that not everybody has the ability to actually, you know, invest to that level. But, I mean, if you're asking me what works, anecdotally, you know, from experience, I mean, you know, you've got to be there for years in some cases, you know. So you almost need to have, I guess, like a parallel program running, outreach that makes sure that these kids are catered for, and then creates that link back into, you know, what you're trying to do at the end of the day. So it's not easy. And I think, you know, there's some clubs and associations who are doing a great job. There's others who would probably love to do, you know, a better job. But I think, you know, the tide's turning and everybody wants to do better. And I'm noticing that, whether it's here in BV, whether it's, you know, out at associations or clubs, everybody realises that there are massive opportunities, you know, to include and benefit, you know, massively from having these young people included. So, yeah, and look, I'm always open to actually, you know, giving some advice in that regard. It'll be very limited advice, trust me. We're still trying to work it out as we go. Yep. But, you know, like saying, hey, what could we do in this, you know, regard? So, yeah, always happy to have a chat to people. And, you know, even if it's devil's advocate stuff, have you tried this, have you tried that? Yeah. Sometimes that can be, you know, the first step to actually taking some action.
Yeah, definitely. And so you guys are involved in a lot of extra stuff that goes on. So South Sudanese Australian Basketball Association tournament. So I've been to a couple of these, and they are unbelievable things to watch. The kids that get up and down in the, like, it is fantastic basketball. Like, the organisation that goes into that as well must be off the charts. I mean, it's been at Eagle Stadium the last couple of years, I think.
And it's coming up again this year. Yeah, December 17, 18, 19. Just through logistical reasons, we're having to have a finals on the Tuesday, which will be a first, but I guess close to Christmas, probably still get a decent crowd.
Absolutely.
Crowd. People will be there.
No doubt. It's a fantastic, well, I do recommend anyone that's got nothing on those, and I understand it's a busy time of year, but it is fantastic basketball to go and watch as well. And you guys have had Lowell Deng come out over the last couple of years as well.
Been very lucky, yeah.
Which is fantastic for the NBA as well. And you guys also have your 24-hour charity shootout. You sort of take us a little bit through that as well.
Yeah, sure. So I guess we're not, look, we're a charity at our essence, and, you know, we give away our service for free, you know, each and every day to these kids. So money's got to come from somewhere. So a lot of my job is just, you know, trying to chase money, to be honest. but, yeah, so we're not, you know, trying to be a charity that's got its hand out, you know, all the time. It can get quite fatiguing, you know, for people to keep hearing of these causes. So we basically have one fundraising event once a year. We do it big, and you're not going to hear from us for the next 11 months, basically. That's our rationale behind it.
It's like that auntie that never won, really wants to go and hang out with at Christmas, then, you know, I want to hear from you at Christmas, and then never again for the rest of the year.
Compartmentalize your, you know, your relationships in that regard. But, yeah, so the 24-hour charity shootout happens in late June, early July, depending on when the dates fall. I'm sure we'll let everyone know or, you know, sort of when we know more. But, yeah, so the concept is really simple. So we basically have 12 hours on the Saturday, 12 hours on the Sunday at Albert Park College, and everyone registers to shoot as many free throws as they can in 15 minutes. So that's the challenge. And you get an online fundraising, you know, platform as when you register, and you know, it's simply a matter of sharing that and watching the dollars roll in.
Yep.
We've noticed, which has been great. So it's a lot of fun. We build a big festival and party around it as well. So you come and do your 15 minutes, but you know, you stay for an hour or so and you know, take in everything we've got going on. And you know, we've had, look, the thing I love about the 24-hour charity shootout is, I mean, obviously, yeah, it definitely keeps, you know, the doors open for us in terms of getting money in. But, I mean, even more importantly, you know, it's a great community building, you know, vehicle for us, because not all people out there who may support Helping Hoops can actually go and volunteer at a program. They can't, you know, give up their time, work, family, coaching, you know. Yeah. So everyone's busy, but we're saying, hey, this is a one time a year to, you know, just come down, give up an hour of your time, do your free throws, hang out, have a chat, you know, just have a bit of fun, and really becomes like a you know, like a family gathering type thing.
Yeah,
as well. It's such a cool thing. And you know, every year as we grow, the shootout grows as well. And you know, we've had people who, you know, kids who can may only hit, you know, 20 or 30 in their 15 minutes, right up to, you know, Chris Goulding coming and hitting 343 in 15 Jeez. Minutes.
Yep.
Yeah, he's okay.
Yeah,
and
he set the benchmark fairly high, unfortunately.
He actually got beaten this year by one of our own kids who set the record now at 349 in 15 minutes. If you're thinking out there what that looks like, make at about 80% clip.
Wow.
So sometimes shooting form doesn't actually help you. You have to be like one of these from the hip kind of
popper shot type stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Video arcade, you know, sort of shooters. But yep. Hey, they went in, and shout out Nahom if he ever gets to hear this for beating CG43. So now it's on next year. We're going to have to get Chris Goulding to jump back in. But yeah, look, I mean, you know, plugging in with us and keeping up to date with everything that's going on. There's a lot of noise created in the lead up to the shootout. And, you know, coaches, your players, people within your associations, your clubs, the shootout's for everybody. So, you know, we really need the support to keep doing what we're doing, but also to grow this thing as well. You know, we don't just want to be sitting here, you know, in 8 years from now, you know, still at 10 programs. You want to be at 40 programs, you know what I mean?
Yep,
so do that, we need more support, and the charity shootout's a fun way to garner, you know, that support from the community.
Yeah, awesome. So people that are looking to get involved and help out with everything that you guys do, whether it be coaching, fundraising, things like that, how do they go about getting involved with those sorts of things?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, you know, our audience, I guess, is coaches. So, I mean, look, the first port of call would probably be to jump on the website, helpinghoops.com.au, and have a look at the locations, you know, have a look at when they run, you know, where they run, what your life is like. And, you know, if you're able to make a commitment, you know, that's something we're big on. We realize that people may be able to come in for one or two sessions, but, you know, can they actually come on a consistent basis,
yep.
get to know the kids get to know you. That's really where, you know, everything starts. But yeah, look, you know, jump on if you are able to, you know, to make that commitment and join, you know, join the team. We'd love to hear from you. We always need, you know, we're just people helping people at the end of the day. You know, we're not building hospitals, we're not, you know, solving, you know, the world's problems. We're just a bunch of well-meaning people who hang out with kids who need a little bit of extra help, and we play basketball.
Yep.
You know, so jump on the website. You can also become a member if you know, you look at those locations, you're like, nah, it just doesn't work for me right now with my schedule. Become a member. You can, you know, make a small donation every month, and that really, you know, goes a long way. And maybe just jump on social media as well with us. I mean, we're just Helping Hoops on everything, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. We haven't got Snapchat yet. We need to.
I don't understand Snapchat well enough, in all honesty.
I was going to ask you about it.
Yeah, no. Oh, don't ask me. You're probably better off asking the kids, in all honesty.
Yeah,
they'll be well and truly.
We need a social media manager from within, yeah. But but all of those, just Helping Hoops, you not only, I guess, get to see, like, we've got stuff going on every day, and there's so much, like, you know, stuff to share. So getting across us on that, and also then if there is something coming up like the shootout or, you know, whatever it might be, you're, at least you're plugged into our community and you know what's going on. But yeah, if you are a coach and you want to lend your skills to us, you know, heaven knows we need more people, you know, in our corner helping us help kids. So hit the website, and yeah, happy to talk to anyone and everyone who may even have ideas that we haven't had yet. And yep. That's exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are a great follow on all things social media as well, like some of the photos you take as well. I don't know if you've got a photography background or anything like that, but you're very adept behind the lens. You do a great job with all that sort of stuff, as well as your personal account that goes with that as well. I strongly recommend to jump on it. It's fantastic seeing the smiles on kids' faces as well that just want to play basketball, and these guys manage to facilitate that really well. So it's obviously recommend it. Thanks very much, Adam, for coming in. Really appreciate
pleasure,
your
mate.
Time.
Thank you.
And anyone that wants to get involved, absolutely jump on Helping Hoops and offer your services. Thanks, guys.